Welcome back to another episode of the Quillette Cetera podcast. You're with me, Zoe Booth, and today I'm joined by the founder of Quillette, Claire Lehman. We're going to be talking about confected radicalism, which is raging against the machine when the machine's already working. It's hit the headlines recently during the Sydney gay and lesbian Mardi Gras, but it's been around since the days of the Bader Meinhof gang. Hey Claire, welcome back to another episode. It's been a few weeks.
Yeah, good to be here.
Today we're going to be speaking about a really interesting article you've had published in The Australian today. It's about confected radicalism. What does that mean exactly?
Yeah, so confected radicalism is just this term I use for young kids, basically, who want to be radicals, but they don't really have anything to be radical about because a lot of the causes that they're involved in have already been successful in decades past. So it's a local news story, but for international listeners, the story is this. There was a very horrible, tragic double murder that happened last week. Two gay men were killed, and the person who has been charged over the killings, I should say alleged killings, is a police officer serving senior constable. And this has led to the board of the Sydney Gay and Lesbian Mardi Gras to demand that police not march, or if they want to march, they can march in plain clothes. Mm. So this has been a big story in the Australian media, and local media have been presenting it as if this is sort of the first time this has ever happened to a pride march. And basically in my column, I just pointed out that actually, you know, police have been banned, uniformed police have been banned at pride marches all over the world. They were banned from a pride march in Auckland a few years ago. And it's got nothing to do with murders. It's to do with the politics of people running these marches, and specifically the younger generation of activists who are coming through who aren't really that interested in building alliances or building bridges with mainstream organisations and institutions, but want to sort of lean into this idea that they're all about radical protest. So mm-hmm. it's just a different, so the piece was just about there being a different orientation to the activism. Mm-hmm. So if you take gay and lesbian activists from the boomer generation or Generation X, they fought very hard to build alliances. Mm-hmm. So finding common ground with all sorts of different people. Whereas now I look at Generation Z activists, and I've been doing a bit of reading on the staff members involved in this decision, and they're not that interested in building alliances. It's more about protesting, representing the marginalised. The partnerships manager for the Sydney Gay and Lesbian Mardi Gras said that there's no such thing as absolute inclusion. If you include some people, you have to include others. Therefore, you have to make the right choice about who you include. Mm. And so the whole thing for him is, well, you have to exclude police. So right. it's a different orientation yeah. to activism of the past, yeah. which was about finding common ground.
Yeah. So the idea is that this is an issue of homophobia, and that there's an institutional or systematic homophobia in the police force. That's what a lot of commentators and activists are saying. And they use the history, which is a tragic history, which is that New South Wales police have not protected gay people, especially gay men in Australia. And as some people know, there was a series of gay killings, homophobic killings, I think in the 80s. So we've got that history. But, I mean, the man who is alleged to have committed these murders was a gay man, and he obviously wasn't homophobic.
Well, it wasn't a hate crime. It was a domestic violence incident.
Yes.
Yeah.
By all counts, it definitely looks like that. So why shouldn't why shouldn't the police be able to march, you know?
Well, I mean, you know, the protests or the march organisers really can have whoever they like marching with them. But what I find interesting is that there's this almost this need to have something to fight. Mm. This need to, it's like the police have to be homophobic. They need to have something to struggle against because, to be honest, an event like the Sydney Gay and Lesbian Mardi Gras has heaps of cash behind it. There's a lot of political power associated with it. It is totally mainstream. Mm-hmm. They have corporate sponsorships mm-hmm. coming out of their ears. The fact that police do march and have a float, like, it is mainstream.
Mm-hmm. There's Westpac, there's, like, all the big banks.
Yeah.
Pretty much everyone is represented.
But there's this tension where it's like, do you celebrate the fact that it's mainstream and that we have, like, you know, there is tolerance and acceptance and it's, you know, totally normal? Or do you want to reject the fact that such event is mainstream and go and try and become more radical and, you know, get rid of corporate sponsorships and get rid of police? Like,
mm-hmm.
and it's just this interesting tension. And to me, from what I've seen, it's the older activists want to keep it mainstream
mm-hmm.
because they fought so hard to get it there mm-hmm. to that point, whereas younger activists actually want the struggle and don't want to want the event and associated events to be as mainstream as they are.
Yeah. So this is something we've seen across like my generation or younger, a little bit older too, across the world, that there's a really strong desire to have something to rail against.
Yeah.
And perhaps it's because life is pretty good for us right now, in the West at least, like, you know, women, look at myself, like, my grandma fought so hard to go to uni.
Yeah.
She went to uni in her 60s.
Yeah.
You know, I could go as an 18-year-old. You know, things are pretty good for us here, and I think we take that for granted. But there is a faction of the far left that really want to act like, you know, there's a war they need to wage against capitalism, against patriarchy, against all these institutions.
Yeah. I wouldn't limit that to the far left. I see it on the right as well, where, like, I see it, like, there's almost a psychological need for there to be issues that are existential.
Mm.
Like, if this issue is not solved, it's going to be an existential crisis for humanity.
What is it on the right usually?
Well, immigration is mm-hmm. one. So, like, you can, like, I see a lot of chatter about, you know, if it, you know, it's not as much in Australia, but mm-hmm. in America in particular, you know, if they don't secure the border, it's going to mm-hmm. be the end of America.
Mm-hmm.
We have been critical of gender ideology, mm-hmm. but I don't see it as an existential threat
mm-hmm.
to civilization. Mm-hmm. You
Some
know
on
what
the
I mean?
Right do.
Yeah. A lot on the right do. So it's there's a difference between criticism of a particular position or ideology or issue, whatever, and then blowing it out to be this, it's going to be the end of the world, this sort of like doomerist or mm-hmm. blowing it up into a moral panic. Mm-hmm. And that on both sides, you get this, there's almost this psychological need for there to be something to panic mm-hmm. about,
yeah.
this need to fight an existential struggle.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I felt a lot of that as a younger person when I was at uni. One of my goals while I was at uni was I need to attend a protest before I finish here. It's like a rite of passage. And I actually never did, although I was very much in those circles. There was, when push came to shove, when there was a protest on, I never fully could commit because I always had like one little niggling issue with, you know, the dogma of that, you know, tribal. And even now, like, I've attended a few like marches against anti-Semitism and stuff like that, but still there's part of me that's like, oh, I don't like being here with the group
yeah.
all agreeing on the same yeah. thing because I don't 100% agree on everything, you know?
Yeah, that's interesting. You're not fully on board with like a mob, the mob kind of.
Yeah,
dynamic. Yeah, that's interesting.
I'm mob phobic. It makes me, I don't like, I'm that's, an only child, maybe.
That's
well.
Why you fit in at Colette.
Yes.
But yeah, so I in this column I use the term confected radicalism to describe some of this type of activism where, you know, an issue like there's lots of issues if you take women's rights, for example. I was born after the big struggles had been won. So I have a choice of whether I can accept that the struggles have been won and I can live my life and be grateful to the women who came before me and who, you know, got these achievements and, you know, these freedoms, that hard-won freedoms for people like me to be self-determining and to live full, fulfilling lives and to have economic independence and so on and so on. Or do I want to deny all of that progress and invent new forms of oppression to be angry about? Like, I think there's a choice.
Mm-hmm.
You can say that there has been a lot of progress made.
Mm-hmm.
The world is, there's still a lot of more progress that can be made. But unless you accept that we live in a time where progress has been achieved, how do you know what's going to work for the future?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, if you can't look back and see that this was done and it works,
yeah,
and people's lives are better because of it, how can you be trusted to make any effective, yeah, changes in the future?
100%. We should be looking at these things neutrally and just looking at the evidence. And Steven Pinker, who's, you know, contributed to Quillette, he's written a lot about this, about how, you know, after the Enlightenment, there's been a huge increase across, you know, for women, for all types of, you know, the world has improved, at least in the West.
Yeah.
And in many parts of, you know, the developing world as well. So I don't know what's controversial about admitting that, but for many people it is controversial. And well, I think I know what part of it is, and it's that if you admit that the world's gotten better, you have to reckon with the fact that why do you feel not happy, you know? And that takes individual responsibility.
Yeah.
You know, like the fact that you don't have the job you want or the relationships you have, or that people are richer than you or more successful than you or, yeah, happier than you.
Yeah.
You can't just blame that on capitalism or, yeah, patriarchy. You know, you actually have to,
yeah,
consider, reckon with yourself,
yeah,
which is hard for a lot of people. Hey everyone, it's Zoe here. We'll be back to the episode in just a moment after this short commercial break. I want to tell you about a really interesting event that's taking place in Brooklyn on the 3rd and 4th of May. It's called Dissident Dialogues, and it's an event where some of the leading thinkers of our time will be speaking. That includes Richard Dawkins, Steven Pinker, Ayaan Hirsi Ali, John McWhorter, and many more. You'll also get to meet Quillette senior editor John Kay, who'll be there, along with Kathleen Stock, Diana Fleischman, Mary Harrington, and many more. There will be much discussion of culture wars, Christianity, Islam, atheism, and everything in between. If you're into intellectual honesty, curiosity, and the desire for truth, Dissident Dialogues is the place for you. It's a place for dangerous ideas. If you want to grab some tickets, you can do so at dissidentdialogues.org and be part of the conversation. Now back to the podcast.
And yeah, and a big reason why we can't accept progress, like on objective terms, is because status is relative, right? So I might live, so if I compare myself to one of my female ancestors who had 15 kids and who had to wash her, you know, wash the family clothes by hand, mm-hmm, and like spent all day carrying water into, mm-hmm, the house with like buckets. Mm-hmm. If I compare my life to hers, like I live like a queen. But in this era, I can't compare myself to a queen because, you know, their status has their quality of life has gone up as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the issue is that in absolute terms, all of our lives are a lot better, but that doesn't mean in relative terms our, mm, lives have gotten better. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we still compare ourselves to our neighbors. We still compare ourselves to people we see on Instagram who have like better clothes, mm-hmm, and more overseas vacations. or like beautiful houses in Sydney. Mm-hmm. Like we still are constantly comparing ourselves, and so we feel inadequate and we feel like we don't measure up. Mm-hmm. But if we actually just took a step back and looked at things through absolute terms, we would realize that, hang on a minute, my quality of life in Australia is really quite good compared to poor people who are, you know, born across mm-hmm. halfway across the world, who don't have running water mm-hmm. and, you know, who don't have sanitation in their village and who don't have abundant mm-hmm. available food. So it's just about what your reference point yeah. is. And I think that, you know, in understanding that we're all hardwired to just measure ourselves against like our neighbor mm. rather than our ancestors or rather than people who aren't mm-hmm. in our immediate context, mm-hmm. I think that can help to yeah. some degree.
But even then, a lot of these, you know, activists, I would say, they would admit that they live well and that they're privileged people, but right. they do feel the need to have this fight. A lot of them, as we were sort of discussing before, don't necessarily have skin in the game. Like when we talk about having skin in the game, like there's Alexei Navalny who died for, he knew he was going to die for standing up for what he believed in. Or our friend Drew Pavlou, mm-hmm. who has the CCP on his back, you know, yeah. for criticizing China and the CCP
yeah.
and standing up for the Uyghurs and Taiwan. And there are a number of people that we know who have risked,
yeah.
even yourself, you know, founding. Yeah, I believe so. Like, you know, you believed in, you saw something that was happening and you took a stand and created Quillette and published authors that a number of other publications wouldn't touch.
Yeah.
And you have risked a lot. And like, not everyone loves you for that, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I don't consider myself an activist and I wouldn't consider my risk to be very great. But yeah, I get the point that you're making, and it is that, you know, some of these movements they're actually quite safe. Mm-hmm. No one's risking a great deal. And it's almost like live action role play. Mm-hmm. Like I went through a period of time where I was reading about the new left movement in the 1960s and 70s, particularly in Europe. Mm-hmm. And there were these radicals who sent like hijacked planes and were like blowing up buildings, mm-hmm. particularly in Germany.
Mm-hmm. Is this like Frankfurt School?
No. Yeah. This is like Bader Meinhof gang. Frankfurt School is okay. earlier. And they were academics, right. not terrorists. But like
debatable, but
yeah. So in these activists were so, they grew up in a time, like, so their parents were mm-hmm. involved in the Second World War, mm-hmm. and their biggest fear, these German activists, their biggest fear was Nazis, and they were so afraid that not all of the Nazis had been purged from German society that they went looking for them. They were like Nazi hunters, and they thought that leaders of businesses in Germany were still sympathetic to Nazi mm-hmm. ideology and so forth. And I don't know, there might have been some truth to that, but what ended up happening was that these far-left activists, those involved with the Bader Meinhof gang, became allied with the Palestinian Liberation Group. Mm-hmm. And so they went and hijacked planes. Mm-hmm. And one of these activists, he recalled he called being instructed to separate Jews on the plane from the rest of the civilians. Mm-hmm. And it was like he became an activist to fight Nazis, and here he was separating out mm-hmm. Jews for punishment
yeah.
from other civilians. So there's this risk that in becoming so, like if you are afraid of something and you fight it so hard, you actually run the risk of becoming what you hate. These Bader Meinhofs were doing the live action role play of the actual resistance fighters in the Second World War, the people who went into the tunnels and actually fought real mm-hmm. Nazis, and they wanted to be them. Mm-hmm. Those were the heroes to these people. And like I feel like for a fair few kids today, you know, they imagine themselves as being resistance fighters. They want to be heroes in their own story. They want Nazis to fight. just like the problem is that there's not that many of them around.
Yeah.
There's not enough of them to fight. Mm-hmm. Like there might be a handful mm-hmm. around. Sure, go on, you know, mm-hmm. fight them if you can find them. But there's like there's the demand for Nazis exceeds the supply.
Mm-hmm. Or there are actual Nazis, but they're not the type of Nazis that they're looking for.
Yeah, they don't. You know, they look a bit different.
Yeah, yeah, like as we've written about on Quillette, there's fascism in lots of different groups. And yeah, like for example, we published a really interesting piece by Andrew Hamel recently about rising anti-Semitism in Germany, which sounds terrible. As soon as you read that, you're like, oh my God, there's been a resurgence in Nazis in Germany.
Yeah, but it's
imagine that they're all tall, blonde, Aryan Nazis. And unfortunately, it's the case that when German Jews are surveyed, they identify that most of the people who have been attacking them are Muslim migrants, which is something really hard to reckon with, especially for the left who are very pro-migration. And, you know, I'm the granddaughter of Greek migrants. I've traditionally been very pro-migration, but when you're when you've got migration from certain countries where anti-Semitism or other social ills is endemic, of course there's going to be anti-Semitism. And so, yeah, my point is that there's fascism in lots of different, you know, sectors.
Yeah, and we have to just be intellectually honest about it, and not like the story that we published that Andrew Hamel wrote was interesting because the German government actually tried to hide this fact, and so the suppression of statistics paint this, you know, basically it was basically a form of government misinformation.
Mm-hmm. Because the government would have to answer to, yeah.
Well, and they carry this burden, they carry this huge responsibility to not let anti-Semitism get out of hand because mm-hmm. of their history. And so they actually have to grapple with the fact that some of their policies may be leading to a resurgence, and that's very awkward and difficult for them.
Mm-hmm.
I don't follow German news close enough to know how they're getting along with that, but yeah.
If anyone wants to read that piece, it's on Quillette.com, and we've been publishing a lot about, anti-Semitism and the war in Israel and Gaza and,
I think one of my favourite pieces that we've published in recent months was the Isabella Tavorowski piece.
Fascinating.
And this has been a learning experience for me actually since October the 7th, of how much the Soviet Union was involved during the Cold War in disseminating anti-Semitic propaganda and just how prevalent it is in the West, like just the slogans, the ideas, the issues, you know. I didn't know how much the Soviet Union hated Israel and how much of an effort it went to spread propaganda after the Six-Day War in 1967. It was an interesting learning experience for me.
Yeah, it's a fascinating piece, and we have a really good interview with Isabella Tabarovsky on our YouTube as well if anyone wants to check it out.
And she's a scholar and she's from the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
And she's a scholar of Soviet anti-Semitism, because the thing about us in the West is that we're very familiar with Nazi anti-Semitism. We grow up, we learn about the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. Well, hopefully we learn about the Holocaust, and we learn about you know, how dangerous that ideology is, but we have not similarly reconciled with the dangers of the Soviet version of the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we have a massive cultural blind spot when it comes to the Soviet.
Okay.
Well, good to chat with you, Zoe.
Yes, it's been great. And let's do it again soon.
Yep, let's do it again soon.
Great. Okay.